Shalom, welcome to another episode of Inspiration from Zion. I'm Jonathan Feldstein, and I have the privilege of being your host, coming to you from the Judean Mountains here in Israel. I like to refer to it as the original Bible Belt. Inspiration from Zion is a program of the Genesis 123 Foundation, whose mission is to build bridges between Jews and Christians with Israel in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. I pray that you will find this, all of those. Through this program, we're excited to connect you to people and stories in and relating to Israel to give you a window to look through, experiencing aspects of life here that you might not otherwise know about. We want this to be interactive, so be in touch with us at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com and send along any questions and any comments about any topic anytime. Or you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, or at genesis123.co. Always stay tuned to the end of the program where we're going to offer you an exciting opportunity, and please share this with others who will also find it of interest. Today, you know, this conversation, I love sometimes how my conversations, as unscripted as they are, come about because of something completely unscripted and improbable. I happened to go out to change some money the other day and went and bumped into my friend Yishai Fleischer, who's also my neighbor here in the Judean Mountains. And we were getting into a conversation and made me think two things. First of all, what a shame I bump into Yishai spontaneously more than on purpose, because it's always provocative, it's always enjoyable, and I always think I need to do this more often deliberately. And second of all, we're speaking now in the week of the Torah, the studying of the Torah cycle of what we call in Hebrew Chayei Sarah, the lives of Sarah in Genesis. We were learning about Abraham buying the cave in Hebron, we call it in Hebrew the Machpelah, in which to bury Sarah, and then the promises, the covenant that is going to go through her and her child Isaac and their progeny. And so I contacted Isha. I said, "Hey, let's have this conversation." And I'm real excited to do that. Yishai is the official spokesman for Hebron, the Hebron community, just south of us also here in Judea. He's a critical thinker, and I mean that with so many. I don't think there's ever a topic that you can raise with Yishai Fleischer that he's not going to be provocative about and have some deep, deep thoughts. And that came up the other day. And you always want to follow, we're going to put the links in the show notes here, you always want to follow Yishai and his podcast and YouTube channel as well. Yishai, thank you. It's late at night here, our time, indicating that we're both super busy, and all the more indicative of what a pleasure it is to have you join me today on Inspiration from Zion.
Very good to be with you, Jonathan.
Yeah. So this week, we're reading about the significance of Hebron, for which you are the international spokesman. Let's talk about that biblically. I think people probably know this who are following, but don't really know the substance. And as much as they may know it, often people don't venture far south, much further south than where we live, to either go to a lovely wood making workshop or shooting range near us at Caliber 3, or maybe giving out some nice food for soldiers at the Gush Etzion interchange. Talk about what are the very penultimate significant things about Hebron that we need to know, that everyone needs to know, Jews and Christians.
First thing for me to work as the international spokesman for the Jewish community of Hebron, it's a dream job. If you love the Bible and you love the people of the Bible and you want to make the Bible come to life, working at a biblical site and helping it grow and to have tourism and education and funding, and also help rid it of the bad name that the wars have brought to it, is a dream job. So it's really a lot of fun for me. And the pinnacle of our year in Judaism, you know, we have the high holidays, and we have a term in Israel that's used in all businesses and banks and government offices, which is Acharei HaChagim, after the holidays.
Right.
But for us in Hebron, we take this very seriously. Acharei HaChagim means after this Torah portion of Chayei Sarah, which is like another month after the holidays, because it's a major effort for us. We host, in a normal year, upwards of 30,000 people at Hebron for Sabbath.
Just okay? That weekend. Just that weekend.
Just that weekend. And throughout the week, and even 2 weeks beforehand, people are coming in and people are paying homage to what my colleague, Dr. Noam Arnon, calls the Shrine of Genesis. And that is a 2,000-year-old building, Herodian structure, that sits atop of the biblical tombs that are 3,500 years old, the tomb of Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebecca, Jacob and Leah. Okay, so all the stars of the book of Genesis, except for Rachel, who's buried in the tomb of Rachel in Bethlehem near to us here, and also Joseph, who's buried in Shechem, the rest, the founding couples of the story of Genesis, which is the, as its name indicates, the foundation of the whole biblical story narrative, it's all centered in this site in Hebron. So that site is very special, and it's visited by, in a normal year, of upwards of 1 million people. And its root is, its Genesis, if you will, is in chapter 23 of the book of Genesis, wherein lies the story of the purchase of the tomb of the patriarchs and matriarchs.
Good, I wanted to get there. Yes.
Well, that's the whole thing. You know, it starts there. It starts in this lots of ink. The Bible is usually laconic, keeps it short, and yet here spills a lot of ink on the negotiation and purchase of a piece of property that would become later the tomb of the patriarchs and matriarchs. Its first stop is to be the tomb of Sarah. Now, extra biblically, in Judaism, we also know it as the tomb of Adam and Eve. Okay, that's not written in the Bible. It may be hinted to, but it's not written in the Bible. But according to Jewish lore plus Kabbalah, the mystical doctrines, Adam and Eve are buried there. But then the rest of the couples, first Sarah, then Abraham, Isaac, and Rebecca, and then Leah. Finally, Jacob was in Egypt at the very end of the book of Genesis, and he says, don't bury me down here in Egypt. Take me to the family tomb in Hebron, and indeed, his sons carry him all the way from Egypt and bring him to Hebron to be buried. And that seals off this very mystical and very special foundational tomb. I get to pray at that tomb every single day. I get to be there and think about it and feel it and live with this shrine, you know? Shrines are something you make pilgrimage to, but sometimes you get a chance to be there a lot. You learn a lot from it. Another person who learned a lot from this site is King David. King David actually ruled in Hebron for 7 years.
Excellent.
The mystical doctrine lays out something that I came to a conclusion even before I found the text, that King David needed to be in Hebron for a while in order to study the concept of the love of all of Israel. And who are you gonna learn that from but the forefathers and mothers, because Israel is their children. And so King David had to nurture from the forefathers and mothers. For 7 years, he ruled in Hebron as king of Judea, of Judah, and then as king of all of Israel. And then once he gets crowned in Hebron as king of all of Israel, he moves to Jerusalem for the next 33 years of his kingdom. So Hebron is a very special place. It's a place of firsts. There are many other firsts, including Caleb, who comes there. And also when the temple service would start in the mornings, the Mishnah tells us you would have to look towards Hebron and see the first light there. That would mean that you would remember the merit of the forefathers and mothers and then begin the service. And so it's a place of firsts. It's the first capital. It's a little bit like Kyoto in Japan, right? You got the first capital and then it's Tokyo. So Jerusalem is the capital. Jerusalem is where the center of worship is, where we pray towards, where there's first temple, second temple, hopefully a third temple. But there's this other energy, which is the place where that holds the foundational couples of the Bible, and that is Hebron.
Excellent. So I want to come back. I'm glad you raised the point. I wanted to bring it up anyway, that Abraham purchased it, I love how you said a lot of ink spilled on that. It wasn't just. There's not just a sentence that said Abraham purchased the cave, or the purchase price, which today purchase prices of private property are public record, so that's normal. But the text also spells out the whole negotiation, and there's a lot of rabbinic commentary about that. Can you enlighten us?
Well, even without commentary, it's actually an amazing text. It reads like a play, And if you know the Middle East, you realize how authentic this dialogue is, because it's a dialogue between Abraham and the Hittites, who are people from what we would call today Turkey. And they had a group of people that were Canaanites, but they were Hittite. And he negotiates with them just like a Middle East negotiation. It's back and forth and back and forth. No, listen to me. No, listen to me. And it's all about honor, and it's all about a kind of slow pace and bowing to the other people and getting what you want. He wanted a parcel specifically that the Hittites owned, and he wanted to purchase it. Our rabbis, our sages, point out that there are three places that were purchased that nobody can deny or nobody can claim that we stole. They are the tomb of the patriarchs and matriarchs in Hebron, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, and the tomb of Joseph in Shechem, And the Bible lays out purchases in all three of those cases. And this is, when I say purchases, I mean for money. I mean, yeah, in business, as opposed to some kind of godly gift or war prize. It is something that we purchased, and the other people gave it to us freely. And so these three places, one can never claim that we stole. Ironically, Hebron, Temple Mount, and Shechem are very much contested places. I guess because the Arabs have figured out how important spiritually, economically, and militarily these places are. But in any case, they're very much contested. But the recommendation is for people to just read chapter 23 of the book of Genesis. Maybe many Bible lovers remember it, but they kind of skipped over it. When you go back to the text, you're like, wow, this is such a conversation, such a back and forth. And the Torah wants us to see how Abraham tried so hard to get this plot of land and how important it was to him. And then he buried his beloved wife, Sarah. One of the unique markers of the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs is that it's the mamas and the papas. Okay. I have searched far and wide. I've not found a similar type burial site that features mamas and papas. It is a monument to the love and the couples that came together to give birth to the biblical family, as opposed to, for example, Mount Rushmore, or the monuments in Washington. Those are all monuments for men, but here you have mamas and papas, what it takes to make a family, and that's a very special element. That's, by the way, why I think you said something about me being contentious sometimes.
Provocative.
One of the fights that I have made in Hebron, even with my colleagues, is that I absolutely fight against the identification of the site as the Tomb of the Patriarchs. I think that very much undermines the beauty of it, one of its most beautiful elements.
Right.
You have Tomb of Patriarchs in many other places, but here you have this special thing of patriarchs and matriarchs together, buried as couples. Yeah. So I accentuate that element of mamas and papas. So therefore, I call the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs. It's a few more syllables, but it's worth it.
No. And it brings out a lot. That's excellent. I want to stick with something. I wasn't even thinking about it until we started speaking. But let's stick with something biblical, not adjacent to the Jewish community in Hebron. There's another tomb, Jethro. And I don't know that I would have thought of it, but we just lost, in the last month, the highest ranking Israeli commander was killed in Gaza, who was a Druze, and they revered Jethro as their prophet. And this past week at the pogrom in Amsterdam, one of the people who saved Israeli Jews was another Druze Israeli citizen. I've never thought about it before, but is there a significance that you can connect the dots to Jethro being the father-in-law and also being there? Moses' father-in-law?
I don't know. The tomb of Jethro that I know is in the Lower Galilee. I've actually visited it one time. It's called Nabi Shuyab.
Oh.
But it's not in Hebron.
Oh, my mistake.
No, we have... There's a few different places where Jethro's supposed to be buried. And I'll tell you... It's interesting. First thing is, we do have a lot of Druze people in Hebron, usually police officers and general and army commanders, including generals. We've had many of them around, so I've gotten to know them very well. That's number one. But I'll tell you what you may have been hinting at, and this is very interesting, but this is definitely controversial. And therefore, I almost never bring it up. But because you brought it up, it happens to be that in some of the most kind of like not first level mystical doctrines and documents, but like second level, higher tier mysticism, there's also a discussion that Moses and his wife Tzipora are buried at the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs. And there's little hints to it here and there, and an amazing discussion. Now, the Bible says clearly that Moses was buried on Mount Nebo, no doubt about it. And that is the plain and correct and simple meaning. But the mystical doctrine says, yeah, he was buried there. But then the angels took him and brought him to the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs. Others say that there's a tunnel from Mount Nebo that connects the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs. And you know, there the old time Jews, we also know the date of Moses' passing, which is the 7th of Adar. And so there are old timers that come to the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs and celebrate Moses, the great leader, whose kind of burial place is hidden. The Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs has other interesting tombs associated with it, including the head of Esau and the head of the son of Saul, and also Avner ben Ner, the first King Saul's general. There's a lot more, but let's start out with the plain stuff, which is the tomb of Abraham and Sarah, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, and Leah, and that's the foundation. And there's a lot more. Listen, it's a very mystical building. It's a very mystical site, but it's also a non-mystical site in a sense. You know, we say that all the prayers in the world go through that tomb first, but on a totally non-mystical reading, on a very kind of square reading, it's a site of Jewish peoplehood. It's the beginnings of our family. It's just that simple. And by the way, we just celebrated another milestone, which is in the year 1166, Maimonides came and prayed at the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs, and he writes about it on the 9th of Cheshvan in the year 1166. He came. And so there are many like special days at this site, and people are coming there all the time. And the most special things that happen are circumcisions, because that's Abraham's covenant, and people come from all over the country to have their child circumcised, their male child circumcised in Hebron at the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs. And we have weddings there. I myself was married there in 2002 with my wife, Malka. So Hebron is a special place. It's a burial place, but actually it's a life cycle place.
Excellent. Thank you. All right, Yishai, it's hard to interrupt these conversations, but we're going to do that with a very quick break and then come right back.
As remarkable and miraculous as Israel is, and its very existence a testimony to God's faithfulness, in many ways, Israel's like most other countries. Just as there are parents anywhere who have stronger and weaker parenting abilities, and adults become a product of situations in their lives that they cannot control, making their ability to raise and care for their own children even harder, that's true in Israel as well. The Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation is committed and takes the mandate seriously to care for the least of these, our brothers, our children. We're committed to bless and strengthen orphans and at-risk youth, to invest in them, to empower them, so that their future will be brighter than their past or their present. But Israel is unique in that there are always threats of war and terror which know no bounds. For children who come from homes that are not safe, sometimes the very scary reality of living in a community that's not safe is too much to bear. We are committed to turning orphans and at-risk youth into children of promise. We fund a variety of programs to help those most in need as widely as we can. We invite and encourage you to join us today so that we can ensure their brighter tomorrow. Please visit genesis123.co to find out more and to send your love and most generous donation today.
Okay, this is fascinating, Yishai. We can go in many different directions. And I think it probably will end up inviting two things, round two, but also I don't want to neglect to invite people on your behalf when they're planning a trip, whether it's with me and Genesis 1, 2, 3 in any setting or just in general. We need to make Hebron great again.
Sure.
Okay.
Right.
Excellent. There's so much more we can talk about in terms of biblical and
lead the way. It's your show.
1,000-year-old history. I want to talk about more modern stuff. And modern stuff, one of the big landmarks, not landmarks, milestones, if you will, in terms of the Jewish community in Hebron was the massacre in 1929. The significance of which was 67 Jews were slaughtered in grisly ways like we saw a year ago, October 7th. And the significance, like October 7th, was it disproves any notion of the state of Israel being significant or the Palestinians wanting to live side by side in peace and having their own state, because in 1929 there was not a state. Can you expand on that? Talk about what the Jewish community was like then, what happened as a consequence?
The Jewish community of Hebron had existed almost without break for 3,500 years, approximately. We're talking about a really ancient place. And as opposed to most places in Israel that Jews haven't lived in for 2,000 years, in Hebron, Jews lived throughout all this time. That's very special. Jews also had very decent relations with the Arabs and the Muslims. Now, when I say decent, they had commerce, they had relationships, they spoke the same language. Jews spoke Arabic. Many of the Spanish Jews that came after 1492 understood the Muslim culture and were able to work well with it. At the same time, to be fair and honest, in the year 1267, Jews were actually kicked out of the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs building as it was made out of bounds for them, haram. It became a totally Muslim site. The Muslims claimed it for themselves and began calling it the Ibrahimi Mosque, and built two minarets on top of it, and also kicked out the Jews from the building itself. So Jews lived decently in Hebron, but as second-class citizens, and were not allowed to enter the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs. They were allowed to pray outside of the building in a southern wall called then the Seventh Step. There was seven steps that Jews were allowed to go up. And that's where Jews were. That was the final stop where Jews were allowed to pray.
That's on the Temple Mount too. Seven steps, yeah.
No, the Temple Mount doesn't have seven steps. It has other. It has different steps, but it does not have a step thing like that. The Jews were just barred from the Temple Mount altogether.
Okay.
But here they were allowed to go up to the building and pray at the wall. It's like the Kotel, which is this like second rate thing that you get. Consolation
right.
prize if you can't go to the Temple Mount. So too, if you can't go inside the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs, we prayed at the seventh step. But Jews lived, at the same time, Jews lived with a certain amount of safety and a normal life, albeit always poor and always searching for funds to help support the community. There were great scholars that lived in Hebron, produced great works, very famous works, including the Talmudic Encyclopedia, called the Zdei Chemed, and many other important books were written there. And there are also great scholars buried there, famous rabbis and holy men. And holy women as well, by the way. We have a very famous Chabad, like a Rebbe, but she was a woman, and her name was Menucha Rachel Slonim, and she is buried in Hebron. She was considered a very holy woman, including by the Arabs, who would ask her to walk on their fields so as to bless them.
Wow.
But in the year 1929, there was already stirrings. Remember that one of the things that people don't understand, I find, is that the birth of Israel really is in 1917. Okay. Really, the Balfour Declaration, and immediately after that, the victory of the British armies against the Turks and the Ottoman Turks in the land of Israel, that was the beginning of the Jewish state. Because already that idea was coalescing. Then in 1920, San Remo Accords, 1922, League of Nations. And so the League of Nations came out with what was called the Mandate for Palestine, right, which is a mandate for a Jewish Palestine. And they were there to enforce it and create it. They had this vision, which was at the time called Restorationism, which is to restore the Jewish people to the land of Israel. So therefore, already 1917, the great reversal, the eviction of Islamic rule in the land of Israel happened, and the Jewish people were beginning their trek towards sovereignty in the land of Israel. Well, at the time, there was a Muslim leader whose name was Haj Amin al-Husseini. He was a brilliant, shrewd, extremely evil. At the time, he was a proto-Nazi, and he later became a full-fledged Nazi and helped Hitler kill 40,000 more Jews in Albania, and he became an important Nazi official. But at the time, he was in Israel, and he agitated against Jewish settlement of the land of Israel. And he found very smart ways to stir up the Arabs into war against Israel, into rejection of Israel. And not different than Hamas today, he was able to use religious sentiments to cause a riot against Jews in Hebron. It happened to be that, excuse me, not Albania, Bosnia. It was Bosnia. He was in Bosnia. And at the time, there was already intelligence pointing to a pogrom, a riot that would happen in Hebron. And the leaders of the nascent Israeli Defense Force, called at the time the Haganah, came to the Hebron Jewish community and said, let us keep some guns here and some fighters here to defend you. The Jewish community of Hebron said, no, you are causing the tension. We have an excellent relationship with the Arabs that live here. We know them, and we've lived with them now for hundreds of years. So get the hell out of here. And what happened is that the worst predictions came true, and a horrific riot went through in August of 1929 through the city, leaving 67 people murdered in the most heinous ways. All the stuff that you could imagine, including the Jewish baker, his longtime worker, threw his boss, the Jewish boss, into the oven and burned him. People, neighbors and friends turned on their associates, and it was a horrific and very surprising bloodletting. And there were Arabs that also saved Jews.
Yes, good for nothing.
And it's important to remember that there were Arabs that saved Jews, and people survived because of that. But mostly, they either looked away or took part in the massacre. And that destroyed the Jewish community of Hebron. And again, there was an effort to try to rebuild in 1936, which was failed. And then Jordan takes over in 1948. And the Jews are basically out of the town from 1929 till 1967. And in the Six-Day War, we are able to liberate Hebron without a shot. And the Jewish people begin to yearn to move back in to resettle a Jewish Hebron. But that's just a little bit of the picture of how we got to at least till 1967 and what happened in the 1929 massacre, which was such a blow to the Jewish community.
It was a blow to the Jewish community and another metaphor, if you will, to what we experienced a year ago with people living again adjacent to Gaza, believing that peace was possible and inevitable, and in many of the communities there, they weren't even armed because they could never have imagined that that would take place.
That's right. And therefore, when people say to me, what changed in your mind October the 7th, I tell him, honestly, really nothing, nothing at all. Really nothing in my mind changed. Not my perspective on war, and not my perspective on the jihad, and not my perspective on what we should have done in Gaza. Like, zero has changed. In fact, our predictions and our view of the situation was only confirmed. So there you go. So that's what happened.
Okay, and in the, correct me if I'm wrong, I didn't read up on this. I'm just going based on my historical memory. In the 1990s, there was some sort of deal made to divide Hebron into an Israeli-controlled and a Palestinian-Arab-controlled. But before even that, it's important to go back to the biblical example, Abraham purchasing the cave. The Jewish community there is small still, and living in different neighborhoods. They're not all geographically contiguous, but the land is purchased, right? This is not people going in and kicking out Arabs from their homes. These are
no.
So can you talk about that?
Well, you know, most of the places that we live were the places that we lived
before
1929. So we were able to recoup some of the properties that were lost, not all of them.
Okay.
Other properties we've been able to purchase. We continue to purchase. You have to remember that Hebron is a very urban place. And so therefore our future in Hebron depends on our ability to be able to buy properties there and to move into properties and to recoup our old properties. In fact, I was just in a house where great-grandchildren of the original owners are moving back in Hebron. That's very exciting.
Yeah.
So we have about 1,000 Jews living in Hebron. We have a sister city called Kiryat Arba, which is the other name of Hebron in the Bible.
Correct.
And we have about 9,000 people living there. We have a block of about 10,000 Jews in this very strategic spot. But there's about 200,000 Arabs that live in Hebron and much more in the greater Hebron area. Which is very strongly Arab. The state of Israel has not yet done a great job of asserting sovereignty. Quite the opposite. Israel in the 90s went through a process called the Oslo Accords, which had within the Oslo Accords Y Plantation, which had within that the Hebron Accords. And the Hebron Accords basically allowed the Palestinian Authority, which is a secular jihadist and corrupt organization, to bring their terror troops into Hebron and to control it. Well, you know, this was, it turns out that giving your land away to terrorists is not a good idea.
It should be a bumper.
Ta-da! You know what I mean? Like, it just does not work. And so today, Arabs living under the Palestinian Authority are brutalized and stolen from, and the kids are, you know, brainwashed.
Yes.
And the mayor of Hebron today is a guy by the name of Tiasir Abu Snena, and he took part in 1980 in the killing of six Jews. And he was one of the terrorists that killed six Jews in 1980. And today he's the mayor of Hebron.
Wow.
So that's kind of silly. That's not a way to do things, really. So it's a militarized zone. Hebron is militarized, and yet with all that I said, it's also safe. Really, we have a very strong presence there, and the majority of the state of Israel and the majority of politicians understand that Hebron is important to us historically, heritage wise, but it's also important to have our army there. Because as we learned from Gaza experience, when you pull your army out, well, the enemy runs amok.
Yeah.
So there's a strategic component to us being there as well.
And even with the army there, and you experienced this, I'm sure, much more, but there was one point a few years ago when my son was in his active duty that my son was guarding there. And we went and visited him. And you could see that even with the army in place, there are a lot of ways that the Palestinian Arabs can and do take advantage. And there are many times that the army is going in on a regular basis into homes and taking weapons and other things that are inevitably going to be pointed at us.
That's right.
Yeah. Yishai, I want to take one last break and then come back and talk about the kind of what's going on now, the contemporary status and looking ahead.
Friends, Israel's at war, and the war may get worse before it gets better, much worse. It's going to be a long war because the enemy is the epitome of evil. It's not just a matter of overcoming troops on a battlefield, but overcoming a theology, an ideology, an evil one. While the Genesis 123 Foundation has been overwhelmed with the support of so many donations to the Israel Emergency Campaign, there's so much more that needs to be done. We've invested your donations that we've received so far strategically to make the biggest impact possible, whether helping with soldiers and their equipment and personal needs, to providing civilian security for outlying border communities, to relocating and settling several families from near the Gaza war zone, launching the global petition drive to support Israel in the face of pressure for a ceasefire, and long-term needs for at-risk children, traumatized now more than ever before. Please take a moment to pause this conversation right now and go to love.genesis123.co and donate generously. We value your trust, and we will keep all donors informed about how and where your donations are being used to contribute to make the biggest impact possible. And when you use that link, love.genesis123.co, you can also send your prayers and words of encouragement to Israelis of all backgrounds. Just sending your love, something that we need so desperately. Thank you, and God bless you and your loved ones.
Okay. This has been great. 1,000 people living among 200,000. I know this, but you're there on a regular basis and you're the spokesperson. What are the challenges?
Well, the enemies of Israel are to be taken seriously. And so we have one challenge, which is the security challenge. You know, bad guys have guns, and we want to bring in tourists, and we want to raise our families there. So that's one. But the other huge challenge, which is more within the realm of the people listening to the show, is what I call the narrative war. And that is the effort to erase our history, to do what I call national identity theft, in which they're taking away the story of the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs, and with their friends at the UN, like the organization UNESCO, trying to recognize the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs as a Palestinian World Heritage Site, to erase the Jewish story, to claim that Israel's presence there is an apartheid thing, or it's an occupation. That's the biggest word of them all, the occupation. The claim that we're the foreigners, that we're the white interlopers, that we're the colonialists. And so the narrative war has been one of the enemy's most successful attacks against Israel, against the Jewish people, and against Hebron. Now, a lot of Israelis and Jews don't understand that once you erase the Jewish connection to Hebron, you have undermined one of the biggest pillars of Zionism, which is our historical connection to this land. And the enemy is a master of erosion. And they erode our sense of self. They erode along with our ignorance, they erode our knowledge of our heritage. And they broadcast fear. They are masters of broadcasting of fear. That is called terrorism, the ability to strike terror in you, even though you have actually not been terrorized, but you've only heard about it. You now have terror in your heart. You've been terrorized. That's why I define terrorism as the broadcasting of fear. And our enemies, if you've been to Israel and you haven't been to Hebron, that's probably because you're either on the ignorant side, which you didn't know enough about this, how beautiful and special place this is, or more likely, you are on the terrorized side.
Yes.
You've been made to be afraid. I like to ask people, I'm like, why are you afraid? And they answer me, and then I go, but why? Until I get them to say, because somebody wants me to be afraid.
Yeah.
Somebody's working actively to make me afraid. And so that is what our enemies have done. And so a challenge for me is to show people the beauty, help people be not afraid, put up pictures of people being there, show people that it's safe and welcoming, and that it's worth overcoming the fears to get to the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs, that it's value to the world. And I pump out, you know, the ideas of what is Abraham and walking in the Abrahamic path. So we are dual warriors. We have to be physical warriors, and so we carry guns and we have the army and all that. But we also have to be narrative warriors. Okay, by the way, Jacob at the end of his life, when he's in Egypt, he gives his kids the spiel about what the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs is. One second. He are you there? He gives his children a long spiel, a long talk about you know, what is the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs. And I tell people, why is it that that Jacob would do such a thing? Why would he tell his kids? They all probably know. The answer is because he was concerned that you have to know your narrative. Somebody's going to come and tell you this is actually somebody else's tomb. There are even archaeologists on the left who claim that this is not the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs. It's just a Edomian cultic site. All kinds of other things they want to erase. So you got these scientists being like, no, it's an Edomian cultic site, even though it says in the book of Josephus what this is, and it tells the whole story, and we know all about it. So you got these kind of guys. Then you have UNESCO being like, no. You know, this is actually a Palestinian World Heritage Site. So bottom line, there's all kinds of people that want to erase your memory or make you afraid, and we have to overcome all of that and security concerns to get to the root of it all, which is Abraham and Sarah.
So I want to come back. I'm glad you mentioned the narrative war, because something that's always puzzled me, that when you go into the tomb, into the building, it looks like an Islamic building. And what I understand why Muslims could revere Abraham. Get it. 1,000%. But they have nothing to do with Sarah. They have nothing to do with Isaac and Rebecca
Jacob and Leah.
Thank you, Jacob and Leah. And what's the narrative there? What's even the connection? Or is it just we're going to own it and erase anything that's Jewish?
There's a term that's used in the West. It's called cultural appropriation.
Yes.
Well, Islam is a master of cultural appropriation.
Agreed.
It's not a bug. It's a feature. Okay. It's the way that they do it. And basically, you can ask any serious Muslim about Abraham, or about King David, or about Isaac and Rebecca, and they'll tell you they were great Muslim prophets. It's just that simple. They were great Muslim prophets. And sure, of course, Abraham is buried there. That's important. And the rest is also important because they were great Muslim prophets. And in general, when there's a holy place, they subsume it. Either they destroy it because it's some kind of pagan thing, or they subsume it. That's called cultural appropriation. So therefore, in their mind, the Ibrahimi Mosque is key to their stuff. It's a holy spot. They're very proud of controlling it, or just controlling part of it. And that to them is very important. And also, they are not dumb. They are smart, and they understand that when you have a superior heritage claim, it gives you gravitas, it gives you provenance. You get to have a hold on that piece of land, so therefore they hold it. And in their mind, you know, they're the boss of the place, and they have come to the Muslim theology is supersessionist.
Yeah,
they believe that Islam came to is the next revelation after Judaism and Christianity.
Correct. And it's important, by the way, that Christians understand, if they don't know, it's not just subsuming Judaism, but it's also Christianity.
1,000%. They quote the name of the Christian God, and they, you know, and they say, okay, but Muhammad came afterwards, and this is the true law.
Right.
That's it.
Right. And if you don't believe it, we'll slaughter you.
Right. So, or not necessarily, because you could be a Christian or a Jew, and therefore you have a certain status as people of the book, but it's a secondary status. It's a you know, It's a second-class status of Dahimi, and you have to pay a certain tax, etc. In any case, but you certainly can't get out of line. In any case, that's the answer to how Muslims see Islam sees the Tomb of the Patriarchs, the Matriarchs. But, of course, there's also people today in the Arab world who actually detest the jihad and want to see Israel be the sovereign there. Just like there's tons of Arabs that want to see Israel be the sovereign in Gaza. And a Channel 12 news report just came out with a bombshell of interviews with Arabs. And they're just like,
oh, yeah. I saw
it's
that.
A bombshell. And it's going to be on my channel as well. And it's not a bombshell for me because I know this stuff. But for regular people, you never see this stuff recorded. And they're just like, just come here and rule here. It's your land. And you're a people of blessing. Barakah. Bring the blessing back. Get rid of this crap called Hamas. It's nothing but a bloodthirsty Shiite garbage. We don't want it. And it's very powerful. And you have the same thing in Hebron. But right now, a very suppressive regime runs it. And hopefully, with time, Israel will recognize how central this place is. Ariel Sharon, the prime minister, at the end of his life, did an interview with Ari Shavit. And he said to him, one of my big mistakes was that I was over-concerned with security. And everybody that would come to Israel, I would take them on a helicopter and show them, the security issues. He said, but I forgot that heritage trumps that. And I should have taken them to the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs first to show them this shrine that nobody else has and our ancient peoplehood. Yeah, it's a famous Ariel Sharon quote that he gave towards the end of his life. So he regretted not accentuating and highlighting the heritage of the Jewish people, which a big chunk of it is in Hebron.
How are you seeing things change in the last couple of years vis-a-vis the future?
Well, I'm happy that this war has finally begun. Just in a sense that this war was coming. It's been a long time in coming. And so, and it's better that we started earlier than later, so that we could start dealing with all of the armament that has been built up against us in Gaza and Lebanon and in Judea and Samaria. And I hope that we continue to prosecute this war to its fullest measure until the point that there's no jihadism left inside our borders and on our borders, on the outside of our borders. So that's one change. That's a big topic. But wars bring changes, technological, sociological, and political and geopolitical. We have a new American administration that's going to have a lot of impact. And so hopefully we will move towards Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel, Jewish independence in the state of Israel, and Jewish holiness broadcasting out of Jerusalem, which is the spiritual capital of the world. So we have a lot of work to do, and we're getting on it.
And what does that mean for 200,000 Palestinian Arabs who were just in Hebron, who were living next to, and yet the Jewish community of 1929 thought that we could just live and be well? What does that look like?
It's remarkably simple. And it's surprising that the answer could be so simple, but we live in a world that's so sophisticated and complex that we can't stomach simple answers. But the answer is simple. Non-jihadist Arabs will not have a place in the land of Israel. We cannot have haters of Israel and neo-Nazis living in our borders and on our borders. It's not going to happen. So they've got to go. They're going to go through either war or expulsion or they're going to deport themselves. Okay, that's one. Decent, pro-Israel Arabs will live in Israel as residents. Residency will be a much broader thing. The Bible talks about it. It's called Ger Toshav. It's a residency status. They'll have a much broader residency status. There'll be a lot of Arabs that are pro-Israel, that want to work in Israel, that want the life that Israel has to offer. And they will have an opportunity to do so, as long, of course, as they're anti-jihadist and pro-Israel. And there will be no other flag. There'll be the flag of Israel. You could keep your identity, as whatever you are. But, you know, there's many Muslims that are pro-Israel, for example, you know, the Kurds. You got to adopt that kind of approach and live amongst us like the Druze live amongst us, you know, as decent law-abiding and with upward mobility. But residency status is going to be a much broader thing. And that's what our Arabs say all the time. Arabs tell me all the time, just give us residency status. That's all we want. That's fine. Give us the blue identity card, i.e. residency status. And that's the simple pathway towards normalization here in the future.
You hear that a lot from Arabs in Hebron?
I've been hearing it for years.
Yeah.
And they don't understand. They don't understand why the hell would we support the Palestinian Authority and the Hamas, who are just Israel haters. They're just like, why do you guys back these guys? They're the worst. And they suppress us. They steal our money. They teach jihadism. Why would you back them at all?
Yeah.
And that's one of the mysteries and the mysteries on the Israeli political left. In any case, those are bad ideas. Supporting jihadism is just going to fail in the long run and has already failed. So the way to move forward is to assert sovereignty, be a bigger Israel. And those Arabs and others who want to live amongst us, they will find an opportunity to do so and with upward mobility as residents of Israel.
Excellent. Before we wrap it up, Yishai, we had a broad conversation covering a few thousand years in under an hour. What's the one thing that we left out that you want to share that people need to take away other than to reiterate, come visit, which I want to underscore?
Yeah, come visit is a very important thing. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem and Israel, but don't be careful with the word peace. It's a dangerous word. Somebody said to me once, like, why don't you like the word peace? It's the name of God. I said, exactly. Don't overuse it. Don't take the Lord's name in vain. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Strength is the way towards peace in the Middle East. Clarity is the way towards peace in the Middle East. Israel's got to be strong. When Israel's strong, all healthy things come through that. What is Israeli strength? It is a broad military strength, controlling sea lanes, from us to Greece and the Mediterranean, and in the south, through the Red Sea and the Sinai, around the Arabian Sea and the Persian Gulf, and all the way to India, and having that partnership there, controlling the sea. So it's one is military, and of course a nuclear umbrella and a airspace umbrella, and it's also economic. Israel's got to become big in medicine. It's got to become, you know, big in tourism and help tourism and a train line come all the way from Istanbul down to, you know, all the way through Israel to Alexandria and to Riyadh and all the way to the Persian Gulf. And we've got to envision an Abrahamic region that's also connected through tourism and through rail and other ways. And we have to become a spiritual superpower, because that's what really the internal trait of Israel is, is to be a light unto the nations. People have to come and connect with the God of Israel in Jerusalem. And Israel's got to see itself as those things. And Israel's got to see itself as the place where you touch the Bible. And I'm working right now on changing the name of Route 60, which is a road that connects most of the biblical cities, and just calling it Route 60, the biblical highway. And we have to own it. We have to own who we are. We're supposed to be big and strong militarily, economically, and spiritually. And that is the way of health towards the future.
Amazing. Yishai Fleischer. So I'm so glad I bumped into you the other day. We'll love to do this again virtually and in person on purpose. International spokesman for the Jewish communities of Hebron, ancient and modern, which is so, so impressive. What a privilege. Follow Yishai on YouTube. I actually get all your updates, and full disclosure, I don't get to follow everything you do, but you're one of the people that I regret not having the bandwidth to do that. So I'm glad for you to grace us with this today. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jonathan. Keep sending that light into the world. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, for everyone who's stayed with us till the end, you know, if you've been following Inspiration from Zion from all of these years, we offer you a special a special gift at the end. You can't see my bookshelf. It's called From Jonathan's Bookshelf. And for now, about 15, 16 months since our book, Israel the Miracle, came out, by the way, in which, by coincidence, this was not deliberate, but Yishai and his wife Malka and one of his daughters is featured in the book, and you'll have to get a copy in order to see that. And maybe when you come here, we'll get Yishai and me and a couple of others to sign it for you and inscribe it. You can get a free copy. It's a $75 value just by liking, sharing, or commenting on the link to this. And we pick one person at random every month to get a copy. So please like, share, and copy. We're always grateful that this podcast is sponsored by our friends at the Willow Run Greenhouse in Culpeper, Virginia. And I really mean this. If you're ever in the area, pop in and just thank them for helping make conversations like this possible. And also thanks to our friends, the Coyne family, for their meaningful sponsorship. Inspiration from Zion and the Genesis 1-2-3 programs are all made possible by donations. And I neglected to note that every summer I spend multiple weeks driving to Hebron, bringing cold watermelon and drinks to many of the soldiers who are stationed along the way and inside the city. So if you want to sponsor something like that, please do so. And also, if you'd like to sponsor an episode of Inspiration from Zion, please, in honor or memory of a loved one or a special occasion, please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com. Again, we'd always love to hear your comments as part of a dialogue and invite you to send any questions as well, especially questions about traditional Judaism for our Ask the Rabbi programs. Please share this with others who will also find it of interest and continue to join us right here where we bring you more meaningful conversations that you won't hear anywhere else. Wherever you are in the world, I pray that you and your loved ones are all safe and healthy, and I send my blessings from right here in the Judean Mountains. God bless you. Hallelujah.